I grew up white, as you can see, in a white suburb that boasted the best school district in the area. My classmates were white, and my family has always been white. And for most of my life, until I finished nursing school and went to start my career in Washington, D.C., almost everyone that I worked with, saw, talked to, and was friends with was also white. When I began work in D.C., I got a small taste of what it felt like to be a minority. Victoria, the nurse assigned to precept me throughout my orientation, was black. My fellow nurses were either black or Filipino. The unit clerks, many of the doctors, and the hospital support staff were all black too. The respiratory therapists on the unit were Hispanic, African, Indian, and Asian. My boss was white, but he was openly gay. I had just graduated from a Baptist college. I had never had a gay boss before. Even my patients, for the most part, looked nothing like me. While my orientation to ICU nursing as a new graduate was challenging for many reasons, my transition to the unit was largely stunted because of my cultural naivety. My parents had always taught me to love all people. I didn't judge or dislike any of my multicultural coworkers. I just didn't have the slightest clue how to fit in. Not only was I now a part of the most diverse team of people I had ever met, I was also a native New Yorker suddenly in the South. On my first day, when I casually answered, "What?" to a coworker's call, the entire staff stopped what they were doing and simultaneously said, "Do you speak to your mother with that mouth?" I had a lot to learn. But I did learn. I learned how to speak to people who were from different lands and lived in different neighborhoods. I learned to accept and predict their varying ways of interaction. I learned about delicious pancette and about sneaking throat-curdling full-strength menthols after particularly hard shifts. One of my colleagues taught me how to braid. Another, the importance of communication with big families. Diversity, which at first was a perilous feat, became a priceless tool. When I started, I wasn't aware of my own ignorance towards color. When I left with love, new friends, and the start of a personal understanding of the strength found in diversity. Kenya Beard, who I met for the first time tonight, is a black woman. I knew this before we met, not because someone described her that way, but because I saw her picture. What I didn't know, though, was that in addition to a myriad of awards and titles, including the Associate VP for Curriculum and Instruction at Jersey College and the founder of the Center for Multicultural Education and Health Disparities, Kenya draws impactful lessons from people that never saw anything in her except the color of her skin. And then she dynamically teaches them to others. I'm so happy, so happy that she's here to share one of those stories today. So, thank you.
Thank you so much. So, what do you think nursing means to me? I am proud to represent the group of 3 million men and women of all ages and races who dedicate their lives on a daily basis to serve others and save lives. For me, being a nurse is truly a blessing. I became a nurse during the early 80s. I know I don't look old enough. A time when minority representation in professional careers like nursing was significantly low. So low, in fact, that it wasn't included on the recommended list of career choices for African American females like me. So I guess I can't totally blame my high school guidance counselor for noticing the color of my skin first, or for being too preoccupied by my color to recognize my level of motivation towards entering the nursing profession, and completely missing my potential to become a nurse scholar. I remember the day I entered his office for advisement. I was extremely nervous. There beyond the door sat the man who I believed had the power to shape my future. The man who charted the path that would determine what my life would look like. He had my best interests at heart. Didn't he? What he decided was not only the truth, but final. After all, he was my guidance counselor, the man who would guide me down the path that led to my future role in society. Oh, I was afraid to hear what he might say. In fact, I didn't think I wanted to hear what he had to say. Just 1 year before, he had sent my cousin to a place that he described as a college. When she arrived, thrilled at the opportunity, she realized she had been sent not to the school of her dreams, but to a school for troubled girls. She had never been in trouble before, and the training program she had been sent to robbed her of her freedom and of her pride. After a month of crying herself to sleep in shame, she begged her parents to bring her home. I crept to the counselor's office like I was walking towards the gas chamber. I was almost tiptoeing, listening for that last minute shout, "Stop! Come back! We got you a stay of execution." I was terrified. What if my guidance counselor envisioned a place for me, one different from my own, where I didn't want to go? What if he decided my future role as someone I didn't want to be? His words carried so much weight and finality in my young mind that the fear of entering his office manifested itself physically. I heard each beat of my heart pounding in my chest, my hands mimicking my heart's racy beat, just kept shaking. As I entered the guidance counselor's office, I noticed him looking down at a manila folder. Never once did he look up to greet me. Instead, he gestured silently with his hands for me to sit down. As I sat on the cold, hard chair, I placed my hands under my thighs and I began to shake my legs rhythmically back and forth. I sat there quietly and stared at him. The suspense was making me sweat. I watched him nodding his head again. He repeated these motions again and again. Nod, nod, turn. Repeat. Finally, he got to the last page in the folder, broke the awkward silence with a few undecipherable mm-hmm sounds, and then suddenly looked at me with a smile. He said his first words to me, "I see you are the fastest typist in the school. Congratulations. I recommend you use your skills to become a secretary." I sat there, suddenly motionless, my swaying legs now paralyzed with my thoughts and heart and breath, as if I had just been given a life sentence. Was there anything else in that folder that could help predict my future? He had certainly stared at it long enough. I just tried to process his words, but I felt confused by their meaning. I couldn't understand. Be a secretary, although it was rather a simple statement. Be a secretary. In my head, the words played in a sudden rhythmic loop. A secretary, a secretary, a secretary. Be a secretary. No! I hate typing. Please tell me you're joking. Please, please take it back. Wasn't this man tasked with guiding going to ask me what I wanted to be? Wasn't he going to ask me anything? Did I even have a say in all this? Why didn't he respond to my cry? Couldn't he hear me? Didn't he even care? It was then that I realized that my words never actually descended down from my brain. My mouth never opened. The sounds of my plea never entered the air or his ears. I was too scared to speak. I could only stare at him and hope that my mental angst would telepathically guide him into telling me something else, anything else. I wanted, silently begged, to be given a few options. I waited for the options, but they never came. My face must have hid the turmoil in my mind because he actually congratulated me again. He closed my folder and told me to tell the next student to come in. At that point, my life felt like that folder. I wanted to open it up again and explore its contents, to read them, to take notes, to flaunt, to cherish, to grow. Instead, boom, it was just slammed closed, off limits. I was relegated to a door that I didn't want to go through. As I slowly stood up from the chair, I somehow exited his office, still not quite understanding why he kept congratulating me. Congratulations were given in response to something that brought you joy. I was sad. After the reality of what he said had sunk in, I started to get my voice back. I walked home and I started thinking out loud. There's no freaking way I'm going to be a secretary, having to type 8 hours a day with my back straight, feet flat on the floor, and don't forget, Kenya, elbows at right angles. There was just no way. I barely survived my typing class. One period of typing for what seemed like a century was enough to last me a lifetime. But luckily for me, I was the youngest of three girls. A little spoiled. Okay, a lot spoiled. A teen like me was not going to type for the rest of her life. As I reflect back on that day, I feel a little bit of compassion on my guidance counselor. Too bad he was wrong. So wrong. Despite my excellent performance on science exams, the rigorous science courses I took, or the fact that I was graduating high school at 16 with a Regents scientific diploma, he could only view me through his narrow lens that lacked any sort of depth perception. I believe my counselor linked my professional potential to the color of my skin. And he thought, typing skills, black equals secretary. He failed to see how my typing skills might become an asset to me during the dissertation phase of my doctoral degree, or how my strength in the sciences could pave the way for a career in nursing. Why couldn't he see past my face and instead equate typist plus science equals nurse scientist? My counselor was a victim of his era, an era that marginalized minorities, labeled them as less than intelligent, even in the face of conflicting evidence. It robbed many of us of our chance to reach our true potential. Well, that was not going to be the way my story ended. I said to myself as I walked home that day, faster than normal, my legs itching with anger and determination, I'd sooner jump from a building that wasn't on fire than sit in an office typing letters all day. So I got into nursing school despite my counselor. I passed despite friends who looked like me that failed. I worked despite challenges of lack of diversity amongst my nurse colleagues. I studied more despite an academic community that persists in its lack of understanding of the cultural needs of minority students. I am still proud. Despite nurses who have treated me or my family members differently because of the color of our skin, I am still fighting for my profession. And my guidance counselor was the only first to stand in my way. Nursing is so worth it. Unfortunately, guys, we still see color in this society, no matter the profession. And sometimes we allow color to describe, determine, and limit our patient or student's capacity, thereby reducing their ability to achieve their absolute best. What my guidance counselor got wrong about me was that color in me wasn't a weakness, it was a strength. Seeing color as a negative was not the way my story ended. In fact, seeing color was just the beginning of a new way to see the unique strengths of me, those I would care for, and the individuals that I would teach today. Seeing color this way changes everything. Seeing color at the bedside provides nurses with an opportunity to listen with intentionality to the unique strengths and needs of individuals, to recreate their truths and provide all patients with high quality care. Seeing color in the classroom, this creates an opportunity for educators to teach in a way that is so much more inclusive and to model behaviors that prepare all students to become more culturally responsive. Seeing color in this generation facilitates an opportunity to look at everyone through a lens of inclusivity and to help young people reach their specific, unique capacity. You see, seeing color is not the end. Although founders of this country tried to use color in that way, seeing color allows for a new beginning, for nurses, yes, nurses, to right the wrongs of society and to strengthen their ability to meet the true needs of all individuals, white, black, brown, yellow, purple, and beyond. For that reason, I am so hopeful and proud that I became a nurse and not a typist.